Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. While the U.S. struggles to creep out of economic crisis, China's economy is surging back. And soon enough, says British columnist and my guest today, Martin Jakes, China will push the West, all of it, aside. Economically, politically, culturally. This hour on Point, when China rules the world. You can join the conversation. Do you believe it, that the great age of the West is done, that China will call the tune of global life? What would that mean? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from London is Martin Jakes, columnist for the British newspapers The Guardian and The New Statesman. He's co-founder of the UK think tank Demos, a fellow at the London School of Economics Asia Research Center. His new book is When China Rules the World, the End of the Western World, and the Birth of a New Global Order. Martin Jakes, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's my pleasure.
You start right off talking about the changing of the guard. I think a lot of Americans, and Westerners for that matter, are aware that China is rising and rising powerfully. But you're saying we're missing something here. That's part of that. What?
Well, I mean, so far the discussion about the rise of China has almost been exclusively economic. I mean, occasionally, of course, sort of military security thing and so on, which is more probably in our minds a hangover from Cold War thinking. But no discussion. Virtually, of the political, cultural, ideological, moral, intellectual ramifications of China's rise. But we know from history that the rise of any nation or civilization is not just an economic phenomenon, but is also all these things as well. So just right, like the rise of Britain or the rise of other European powers like France, or of course in the more recently the rise of the United States has not just been an economic phenomenon. It initially is most importantly an economic phenomenon, but in time the United States has come to exercise huge influence across a whole range of subjects, and I would expect the same to be true of China.
You're right, it's going to be rough for all of the West to accept. It's going to be a huge trauma for the United States. Describe what you see coming there.
Well, what worries me most, Tom, is that I think the United States is almost completely unprepared for this. I mean, it's only about 10 years ago since your previous president, George Bush, really was elected on the belief and proposition that America stood, or the world stood, on the eve of a new American century. I mean, just a total misreading of the underlying trends. And it's only really, I think, with the global financial crisis that has been traumatic for the United States, and Americans, or a section of American opinion, has begun to realize that at least its own power from being sort of unlimited is limited, and has begun vaguely to wake up to what the rise of China might be. But these are still very early days. And the danger, I think, in terms of American reactions and so on, is that if it's not prepared, then the sort of response is less predictable, less thought out, less thought through, less composed, less assured. So this worries me. Of course, I like to think of myself in some ways as a bit of an expert on decline, because my whole life from birth to now has been framed by British decline since the Second World War. It's not the end of the world. It's not as if we're a poorer country than we were in 1945. On the contrary, we're a much richer country. But it is it does require a big psychological shift in a people, in a nation, from thinking of itself as really the arbiter of the world, or one of the arbiters of the world, to thinking of itself in more modest, sharing and participatory terms.
And you write, Martin Jake, that Britain's decline will look back on as relatively easy because it was a handoff to another Western power, its own one-time colony, the United States.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point. I mean, one of the problems I think we all have in the West of getting our minds around the rise of China is that ever since the British Industrial Revolution, which kicked off this modern era, in around 1780 onwards, then rivalry and the rise, in particular the rise and fall of powers, has been basically, with the exception of Japan, been shared out between Western powers, firstly European powers and then the United States. And of course, when it came to the decline of Britain and the rise of the United States and the shift in the centre of gravity between the two, with Britain relinquishing global hegemony and the United States in time achieving it. This was, in some ways, this was a comfortable process because there's a lot of common language, there's a lot of common history, there's a lot of common cultural assumptions that are involved. Now, China is a completely different proposition because China... not only doesn't speak the same language, but it's not the same kind of language, in that it's an ideographic rather than alphabetic language. But that's just one small example of a very profound difference between Chinese civilization and Western civilization. And unfortunately, one of the characteristics, I think, of the West, and I include Europe and the United States when I say this, is that... we still are very ignorant of other cultures. One of the penalties we've paid, or we are paying and in the future will pay, for our overwhelming hegemony or leadership over the last 200 years is that we've never really had to think about other cultures and in the same way, and to turn ourselves inside out in seeking to appreciate them. This, we've always been basically dominant in our relationship with other cultures and other societies outside the West.
Other cultures have had to work to understand the West because of that power.
Exactly. Every other society in the world over the last 200 years or more has been obliged to turn itself inside out in the face of Western ascendancy, most obviously and strikingly during the period of European colonialism, but not only that. I mean, in the period of American ascendancy subsequently. So every other society actually has an experience of this problem, except Western societies.
You say that China.
So this is going to be very traumatic.
You say we'll talk about what that trauma might look like. You say China's playing a long game here. We're reminded of Henry Kissinger talking with the Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai years ago, and Kissinger asked him about the French Revolution. And Zhou Enlai, this would be in the 70s, said it was too soon to say in the 1970s. if the West is out, U.S. in the lead, what gets dethroned and what replaces it, Martin Jakes from China?
Oh, I think this is probably such a big question that it's almost impossible, really, to get our minds around it. Because we would have to have really a very intimate understanding and grasp of Chinese history and culture to be able to sort out what this might mean.
Get us started, at least.
Exactly. I think that, first of all, the first assumption we must make is that that many of the values and assumptions that we've made hitherto, which are Western assumptions, Western ideas, concepts, will be decentered, if not dethroned. By decentered, I mean they will no longer be necessarily the subject of global discourse. They will be part of the global discourse, but maybe often at the edges rather than now, we assume absolutely at the center.
And what kind of ideas and or presumptions are you referring to? What sort? Like what?
Well, I think the assumptions about democracy, actually, or the way we see democracy. There might be many ways of having democracy that we haven't thought of. But the way we see it now, which is quite a prescribed form, or, for example, the rule of law and an independent judiciary, or certain assumptions about that we've come to make about the nature of education and what matters in the process of education, or the nature of parenting. I mean, I'm now moving into more cultural areas, or assumptions about what is the dominant political unit of international relations, namely the nation state. This has been an assumption for centuries. So in all these things, which, you know, are meat and drink, we assume them rather like the air we breathe. And I don't think we can. I'm not saying they will all fade away, because I don't think they will. I think some will stay, some will transmute, and some will take a back seat. But that's the kind of shift, I think, that we have to conjure with. Meanwhile, many of the sort of propositions which have been central assumptions to Chinese civilization will become much more central in global discourse.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China and the 21st century, maybe the 22nd and more. My guest says it will be a whole new world with the West, Western power and Western assumptions in the back seat to China. Martin Jakes joins us from London. He's author of When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order. Martin Jakes, questions for you from our listeners. Tim in Toronto, Canada. Tim, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I'd like to ask your guest if he envisions a possible rivalry like we saw with the Soviet Union during the Cold War between the U.S. and China, a sort of arms race, perhaps, and even a possible competition for the rapidly depleted natural resources on the planet.
Thank you, Tim. Martin Jakes.
Hi, Tim. I don't, actually. I don't think the Chinese will play their rise like that. I don't think they see their rise in those terms. They've actually not placed a great deal of emphasis on military expenditure and military capacity. I mean, it's been growing, of course, but they've not seen themselves in direct military competition with the United States, and they haven't wanted to. And one of the reasons they haven't wanted to is because ever since the reform period started in 1978, the Chinese have been very anxious to have a very good relationship with the United States. And by and large, the relationship has, I think, been a relatively successful one. So while I expect we'll see tensions and conflicts, and I think they will grow because, you know, the rise of China and the decline of the United States, inevitably, I think, will be the occasion for that, I don't expect it to be a rerun of the Cold War.
I read you as almost saying it won't be that because the U.S. won't be up to it, that it's a more subtle process, and by the time Americans come fully alert to what's happening, they simply won't have the power to confront China.
Well, that's another angle to it, Tom. I think that's possible. I mean, really the problem that the United States faces with the rise of China is not a military one, it's an economic one. I mean, what is powering China's rise is this extraordinary economic growth, an extraordinary process of economic transformation. And if the United States wants to meet that challenge, then it's got to remake itself economically. Now, of course, that would make a difference. Personally, I think it will only make a difference up to a point, because I think it's just one of those great kind of historical secular changes that you get very, very occasionally in history, you know, where one society rises for reasons that we don't all understand properly and another declines for the reasons that we don't all understand properly.
Here's a pushback from Facebook. Wes says, you know, maybe economically they're headed for the top spot, but he says, but their communist regime and civil rights violations will prevent any political or cultural takeover. I guess it means globally.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think for Western societies, China's record on human rights and lack of political competition makes it, in our eyes, where we take this these as necessary and we assume them, makes it the country much less attractive. I don't think, by the way, that this is true in the developing world. The developing world don't see China in the same way. They attach different importance to other values. So China's economic rise, its economic performance, the extraordinary, the very, very competent role of its government in this process, the relative generosity of China when it comes to trade and aid, all of these things mean that by and large in the developing world, I'm thinking, for example, of East Asia, where a third of the world's population lives, or Africa, or Latin America, the view of China is shaped by rather different considerations, I think, up to a point at least.
Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, and Matt. Matt, you're on the air with Martin Jakes in London.
Hi. One of the things I've seen with culture being moved between the countries between China and America is that a lot of their students come to America or to Europe for their higher education. What happens when we start seeing the reverse, where a lot of Western countries start sending their higher education students to China? Would that help mitigate some of the cultural differences as those students go back to their home countries?
Good question, Matt. Martin Jakes, will it happen, and what will it mean if it does?
Well, it is a good question. At the moment, it barely happens at all. I mean, the Western students that go and study, for example, in Chinese universities like Beijing University and Tsinghua University and so on, basically are studying the Chinese language overwhelmingly. And there hasn't, for example, most American students. And there isn't much else. But I think over time that will change. And I think we can anticipate that universities like the ones I mentioned will become, you know, world-class institutions. And I would encourage students to go and study at Chinese universities. I think it's a very good way of finding out. I mean, one of the things that's really struck me, and I've obviously been to China many times, is that Western expats in China, not just students, but Western mm-hmm. expats, do have a different understanding of China to people who've never been there. And especially here, I'm talking about people who've worked there. They know that the traditional Western explanations of what's happening to China and the prognosis for China don't really work because they can see it with their own eyes. And also they're excited by it. So I think going to China, not just as tourists, a good idea to go as a tourist, but to go and work there or study there is a good idea.
Exciting, but Martin Jakes promises trauma at the same time in When China Rules the World. China rising and changing. Here's just out today. China vehicle sales in 2009 went past the U.S. to land in the world's top spot, first time ever. There's on the economic front. On the cultural front, here we've got the first Mr. Gay China pageant, and it's being, you know, permitted and more or less supported in China. Homosexuality was illegal just a handful of years ago. Martin Jakes in London, please stand by. I want to get another perspective on this. Susan Shirk joins us from San Diego. She is chair in China and Pacific Relations and director of the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation at the University of California, San Diego, author of China, Fragile Superpower. Susan Shirk, welcome back to On Point. It's good to have you again.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's nice to be with you again.
Martin Jakes, you wrote about the fragile superpower. Martin Jakes says it's big, it's rising, and it's going to turn the world upside down. The era of Western preeminence is ending around us right now. What do you make of that, Susan?
Well, I agree with much of Martin's book, and I think it's the overall argument about the rising China and its global influence is correct. What I don't agree with is that the Chinese are really so confident that history is on their side. And in fact, whereas Martin sees a cultural, unchanging China, I see a much messier situation inside China, and that its leaders are really very nervous about the future. Admittedly, the Chinese public is feeling more confident. We see that in surveys, and Martin includes some of those surveys in his book. But the Communist Party leadership, this is a communist authoritarian regime. It's not the Mao's regime. It's changed quite dramatically. But it still has pretty weak political legitimacy inside the country. And therefore, they have a fetish for control. And there's a substantial amount of pushback against that inside the country. So I think China's political future is much less predictable than Martin sees it.
So are you saying...
That will be very important.
Are you saying, Susan Shirk, then, that the West, the United States, can presume that its dominance will go on because China's internal conflicts will keep it from the power that might permit it to project its cultural umbrella over the world?
No, I'm not saying that, and I certainly think that the United States should get used to a world in which it is no longer able to tell everyone else what to do, that it is not just China, but India, Brazil, and other large developing countries are also pressing to play more of a leadership role. And the United States needs to respond to that, and I think it is. You see that, for example, in the creation of the G20 rather than just the G7 making decisions about the global financial crisis. And actually, the United States does have this great advantage of it's not just the U.S. standing out there facing China. It's a whole global system of international organizations that we and other countries have helped create since the end of World War II.
But Martin Jakes is essentially saying that may be history. He's talking about a new global order, that Chinese values will sort of rewrite those assumptions and no doubt in time institutions, as I read him, Susan.
Well, I think that those institutions will evolve with a more active role from China and other large developing countries. But I think they can still help maintain global cooperation and effectively constrain China's own actions as well as our actions. So I think China right now, and Martin in his book describes this quite accurately, China has really benefited from this global and is a big supporter of the global order.
Well, Martin Jakes, we can't really have it both ways. What is it, big trauma in China's rise, or, you know, things go along more or less as we know them because we have institutions and China has a stake in the global order as it is?
Well, I think we're talking about quite a big complex process here I think that the rise, I agree with a lot of what Susan has just said. I mean, I think that the rise of China will be traumatic for the United States. That doesn't mean that it's going to end in military conflict or has to end in military conflict. But I think it will be a difficult because, what Susan's talking about, for example, which is America has to get used to a situation where it can't run the world or think it can run the world. Actually, it's going to go further than that because, in time it will not be the most important country in the world either, although it still is at the moment. And that will be traumatic in all sorts of ways because so many of our assumptions in the West are based around the idea that we are dominant. Now, what will happen to the existing global institutions, I think, is a difficult question to answer. There are various possibilities. One possibility, for example, is that the two main institutions of the American International Economic Order since the Second World War, namely the IMF and the World Bank, will be reformed along with the process of the rise of China and, as Susan correctly says, India, Brazil, and so on. And they will come to reflect the new sort of realities in the world. That's one possibility. I personally think that it's unlikely to be the full story. The other possibility, maybe working alongside of it, maybe interacting with it, is the rise of new institutions alongside the old institutions. I mean, the IMF, for example, is a much weaker body than it used to be. And if one looks at what's happening in East Asia, then the IMF is no longer a very significant institution at all. But what is going to become much more significant, for example, is East Asian Monetary Cooperation. Remember, this is now the largest economic region in the world, larger than North America and larger than Europe. And the result of that may well be, and I know the Chinese are now very interested in this, is an East Asian Monetary Fund of some kind. Mm. Now, once that exists, the IMF won't really matter in East Asia anymore, will barely matter. And trade will increasingly take place, I think, may well take place no longer so much in the dollar over time, especially when the RMB is made internationally convertible.
And so,
I think we could see quite a complex process, Tom, whereby on the one hand, the existing institutions continue to exist, continue to have some importance, and are reformed, but maybe not nearly enough and not nearly quickly enough, but they are, but they remain relevant. Mm. But alongside that is the process of the creation of new institutions. This, after all, is we're not talking about, you know, a process taking place over a year or 5 years. We're talking of a process which takes probably several decades, really.
Susan Shirk, do you buy the world-changing notion here? If we come back in half a century, a century, we'll see a world where different values dominate, and they're Chinese values.
No, that's the part of the argument that I definitely do not buy, because I don't think China stands for much other than economic success and scale. And I think that Chinese society today is a pretty dog-eat-dog, amoral place, and that's one reason that the Communist Party leadership is trying to kind of recreate Confucian communism inside China. But I don't think it has a lot of appeal even in China. I think people make jokes about it. And I don't think it has a lot of appeal internationally.
Maybe the world becomes a dog-eat-dog, immoral place if China is the big power. Or a Confucian place.
I think the argument is really that Chinese political culture and Chinese values will dominate the world. And here I feel that the values, I wouldn't even call them Western values necessarily, but the values of rule of law, of accountability, of fairness, of anti-corruption, all we may not realize all of them as much as we would like, but those values really do have a lot of appeal internationally, and I don't think that will change.
Susan Shirk in San Diego, author of China, Fragile Superpower. It's always great to get your perspective. We appreciate your joining us today.
Well, thanks very much. It's congratulations to Martin on an important book and an important dialogue.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks
very
for joining
kind.
Us.
Thank you.
Martin, we just have a few seconds before the break, but as she goes, she says, you know, congratulations to you, but your bottom line is wrong, that China doesn't stand for much, and so it won't dominate global values, assumptions.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's more complicated, but Susan
yes.
agrees with some things
yes,
and
indeed.
Not with others. But I think that on the question of I'm sorry she's gone, because I disagree with her about this question of Chinese values and the fact that China really doesn't stand for very much. I think it's this is too easy to dismiss such a culture, such a civilization, such richness in many ways.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China and the 21st century with Martin Jakes. He joins us from London. His new book is When China Rules the World, the End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order. It's getting a lot of reaction all over the place. China itself says, hey, what, us? We're just working hard to feed our people. Here's Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao in an interview with China's state media explaining why economic growth is just the top priority there.
A huge population, big regional differences in development, and widespread poverty, he said, This is still China's basic situation.
A developing country just trying to do the best it can. Martin Jakes joins us from London. Martin, a couple of responses here. One from the web. This is from JC saying there's no doubt that global power is shifting to the east. Large U.S. banks and investment houses started shifting the bulk of their money there 10 years ago. They've drained the domestic population of much of their wealth to do so. Our own banks have left us little monetary power or manufacturing power to combat it. But then here's from Twitter. This is Bombayologist Shekhar Krishnan says, is history only the succession of civilization hegemonies or closer integration of people and markets outside nation states? He says, he writes, theories of the rise of China or India are a kind of imperial nostalgia for the countries formerly known as the West, suggesting your basic notion of a new, you know, power rising is kind of a Western notion, Martin.
Well, there's probably some truth in what he says, but I think that while some form of nation state, or in the case of China, nation state come civilization state is the basic unit, and there's all sorts of reasons why this remains the case and is likely to remain the case for a long time to come, whatever the process of globalization and so on, nations will rise and fall and exercise more or less power.
Let's go to Iowa City, Iowa. And Steve, you're on the air with Martin Jakes.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
The big question is, to me, Cartesianism or the Enlightenment and all these airplanes and Rolexes that they copy and all the things that come from individual human spirit, not from a Confucianism top-down system. You know, there are people right now that are living off the fruits of René Descartes' skull. And how possibly, even China, and China invents very little. China is great at top-down stuff, Confucianism, but how in the world can the world survive without René Descartes, without the Enlightenment, and without the fruits thereof?
Great question. Martin Jakes, first of all, would it in the future you envision, and could it, to Steve's question?
Well, it is a very good question, an important question. I think that that China is not a product of the Enlightenment, of the European and Western Enlightenment. It has been obliged since the middle of the 19th century, and a very painful century it took, to learn certain fundamental advances that were products of the Enlightenment and particularly European industrialization. But it is not necessarily that the Enlightenment principles, in my view, are not necessarily a precondition for China's economic success. And I don't think that the evidence suggests that that has been the case. What we have to remember here...
But can we just pause there for a moment? Because Steve is pointing in passing to lots of innovations in science of the last couple of centuries that are key to our global economy now. And he's suggesting that in a Confucian top-down system, you don't get those and you get a kind of drought.
Well, I mean, China's had a Confucian top-down system for a lot longer than the last century or so. In fact, it goes back many, many centuries. And for a long time, for hundreds of years, particularly during the Song Dynasty, you know, the 11th, 12th century, China was easily the most inventive society in the world. And many of the inventions which were subsequently to power the pre-industrialization and industrialization era of Europe were taken from China. It's not true that it all started in Europe. But actually, the baton was taken by Europe from China. And today I would say that although China is still essentially just like Japan was in the decades after the Second World War and the Asian tigers like Taiwan, essentially an adaptive rather than an inventive society, that is because it's still a developing society. A developing society cannot afford, like a developed society, to spend a lot of money on research and development. It's not in that position. All the Asian tigers have been through that stage. But already China is beginning to flex its innovative muscles, beginning to. It can't spend much money yet, but it is beginning to. And so, for example, all the indications are that it's going to become a leader in green technology, in solar power, in wind turbines, and so on. Likewise, China is already right behind the United States in terms of scientific papers on nanotechnology and so on. Now, this is even when it is a poor developing country, which is what it remains. But I think that we would be very mistaken to think that China is not capable of being a very inventive society. That has not been the history of Chinese civilization. In fact, Chinese civilization has been, to be frank, a more inventive civilization over the last 2,000 years than Western society.
You're going back to paper and gunpowder and the sort of high peaks there. Let's go to Ithaca, New York.
I mean, all the maritime, all the things which enabled, or most of the things that enabled Europe's great maritime journeys and so on, were drawn from what had been achieved in China.
The astrolabe. Clint, in Ithaca, New York, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that the Taoist, Confucian, Buddhist background of Chinese society combined with the socialist recent past actually bodes really well for the Chinese hegemony as it proceeds. I think that
why, Clint? How do those add up to an advantage to you?
I think that the world needs a more, shall we say, Oriental perspective on growth, for example. And I think that ultimately the Chinese model may prove to be better for the world in general.
But Chinese growth so far has been, you know, pretty brutal on the Chinese landscape. What about that?
Yeah, I agree. But the fact is that they are a developing society. And I think in the long run that the background of Chinese society may well prove to be a better philosophical model for the world in general than the Western model has been.
Clint, thanks for your call. Martin Jakes, if we could put Clint's observation together and still hold Steve's in Iowa City in mind, saying he thinks the Enlightenment will go. Clint welcomes the kind of Confucian Taoist way. What will it feel like? I mean, try and give us a flavor of this future. Do you agree that the Enlightenment, sort of the bedrock of Western life of recent centuries, will slide off stage? And do Taoism and Confucianism step on? And what does it mean for the world if that the feeling of daily life, of our interactions, of our assumptions, if that happens?
Yeah, and of course it takes us back to Susan's points as well earlier. I think these are very important contributions. I do think that Enlightenment principles, I mean, the Western way, if you like.
Individual rights and creativity and right.
Well, creativity is going to remain important, but I don't think that that necessarily the Enlightenment package as we've had it in the West is the only favorable environment for creativity. I think we'll see. But I don't want to say that whether Western certain aspects of the Western Enlightenment will inform China and India and so on. I don't think it all goes. I don't think it works like that. I think that certain things are recuperated and handed down and adapted and combined with other things. Can I make this point? You see, Tom, when Susan was saying earlier on, well, you know, what have they got to offer now? Look, you know, I mean, what sort of, it's not an attractive regime, it's a mess and so on. Now, I'm not convinced by this argument. I think we consistently, because we're very influenced by the Cold War and what happened to the Soviet Union, we think we know what the Chinese Communist Party is. It's a bit like the Soviet Communist Party. I don't think that's true. They might bear the same name, but the Soviet Communist Party was utterly unable to reinvent itself. the Chinese Communist Party in the 1970s reinvented itself. That it was capable of doing that because it had deep popular roots, and it was cynicized in a way that I don't think that the Soviet Communist Party ever had those kind of roots. And it did something else. It showed itself capable of adapting to and articulating itself with traditional Chinese values, which were essentially Confucian values. In my book, I argue, you know, that in my view, which is more important, the communist period or the Confucian period? Of course the Confucian period, because most of that still shapes what China is, how the Chinese see the family, how the Chinese see moral values, and so on. But the socialist, you know, the communist era has adapted to that. And so what one has actually is quite a powerful body of ideas and arrangements and so on, which has not only presided over this extraordinary period of economic growth, but also survived it. Because those kind of growth rates can put enormous social tensions on a society, and have done in the case of China. But I think that actually China has quite powerful shock absorbers. What are those shock absorbers? They lie in the civilizational inheritance of China and the values and relationships that stem from it.
But if I may, I mean, we all watched the news just recently where the Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo was sentenced to, a decade in prison for subversion. He was involved in getting Chinese intellectuals together to call for more independent judiciary and freedom of speech and free trade unions and so on. You have had this dialogue going on in the UK with Will Hutton at The Observer, and he speaks to the point you just made and says this. He said there's no more enthusiastic exponent of the thesis that China is a civilizational state than the party's propaganda department, the party that takes refuge in some conception of Chineseness to excuse itself from the consequences of authoritarianism and shore up its own crisis of legitimacy, Martin Jay.
Well, of course, in arguing what I argue, I'm not defending the human rights behavior of the Chinese government and the imprisonment that you've just mentioned.
But are you saying get used to it? That's the way it's going to be.
Well, I don't think we you know, whether we get used to it or not, I don't think we will. I think for us this is unacceptable. For me, it's unacceptable. I'm brought up in a Western tradition. Is it going to carry on in that sort of way indefinitely? No, I doubt it. Because actually China's, you know, over the last 30 years, China has changed a lot. I mean, you know, we're talking about the period since Mao, which was a period of great arbitrariness. And now there are still the situations we're describing and so on. There's still many things, but it's a much more regulated, codified and orderly society than it was 30 years ago. And I expect that process to continue. And this is partly a product of the fact that it's been modernizing.
But, you know, your book's thesis as it comes to the United States is Americans wake up, you're kidding yourselves if you think things are going to go on as they have been. You know, but now I hear you kind of, it sounds like you're sugarcoating it, giving us a little lullaby. Is it trauma or is it, oh, things are going to be just, you know, it's fine, never mind. China's changing.
No, I mean, the sugar is not to say... I'm not saying that there are two different questions here. One is the rise of China and what the rise of China will mean. Now, I'm saying that the rise of China will not just is not just an economic phenomenon, but will also decenter Western values, and all sorts of values and ideas associated with China will become much more central in global life from, you know, a civilization state, some of the experiences of the tributary state system, Confucian values, different sorts of legal proposition. For example, in the Spratly Islands dispute, they use intertemporal law rather than territorial law. All of those things are going to become much more important. Now, exactly what China will be like in terms of what will its human rights record be like and so on in 20 years' time, 30 years' time, I would imagine that China will have a much better human rights record in 20, 30 years' time. But, you know, I could be wrong.
And what about the rest of the world? Does it change? Well, is Africa's future, for example, changing if you can look in the, you know, in the crystal ball as China rises and the West recedes? Not that it's had such a great ride with the West necessarily, but nevertheless.
Well, I mean, Tom, Africa, we don't need to look down the road. We can see it happening now. I mean, this has been one of the great changes of the last decade. China's involvement in Africa really is a fundamental displacement of the West. Africa has obtained great economic benefits from its relationship with China.
Here I've got a web comment saying, you know, China's the new exploiter of Africa. They've supported the worst dictators, guns to Zimbabwe, tyrants in Congo, and right on down.
Well, you know, compared with the Western record in Africa and who we supported, from Mobutu to Idi Amin in Uganda, the Chinese record is, compares very poorly with the stains of the Western record in Africa and, of course, of European colonialism. But the point I want to stress, and this is how it's seen in African by African governments and African people, is by and large China's involvement with Africa over the last 10 years has been viewed as an overwhelming positive. Why? Because China has basically greatly increased the prices of the raw materials, so that has meant that economic growth has been much faster over the last 5 to 10 years in Africa than it was previously. And Africa is in a different, it feels a new confidence. And the main reason has been the involvement of China.
And there's
so
just one.
That's a very interesting development.
And just one continent. Martin Jakes, we've just begun to scratch the surface. We'll have to have you back. I hope you'll come. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thank you.
Martin Jakes, his new book is When China Rules the World, the End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.